Thank you. Yes, last week my daughter and I returned safely from our excursion to the Holy Land, thank God. Thank you. Thanks. Yes, once again, my brother Stephen and I had the privilege of leading the First Fruits of Zion study tour on a vigorous crash course, Introduction to the Biblical Geography, History, in the land of Israel in general. And once again, we traveled from Dan to Beersheba, although not in that order, actually from Beersheba to Dan. But in the Bible, it always says from Dan to Beersheba, which is the same as saying from north to south. So we traveled north to south, and we traveled Yamavik, Bekedma, Tsaphona, Venegba, right? North, south, east, west, you know, the four compass points, the whole land, as it were. And of course, I wish I could have taken all of you with, every one of you. And in some sense, I know that I did, in as much as I certainly remembered you in my prayers when privileged to pray at holy places, as you remembered my daughter and I in your prayers. And your prayers were evident and carried us and sustained us through the trip. Miriam and I were pleased to have the opportunity to meet up with my son, Isaac, in Jerusalem. And we hosted him for the full duration of the Sabbath at our hotel and then some, and we were privileged also to spend time with Shana Detweiler of the Israeli Defense Forces, who met us at the airport and joined the group on weekends, on her weekend leave, to spend some time with her sister, Becca, and my daughter, Miriam. And Isaac and Shana both send their greetings to Beth Emmanuel, and Shana particularly expressed her fond affection for her many friends here, and so I discharge my duty to pass those greetings on to all of you now. So you might think that I should be well rested and recharged after enjoying 2 weeks of vacation, but these trips are certainly not vacation time for me. They're part of my job, actually, and they are taxing and they're exhausting, and the load that I carry in these trips is more than I typically do in a week. But nevertheless, my brother, I don't know how he does it, because he and his wife Mona invest far more into these trips. I can't express to you how much work is involved in taking care of 44 people in a foreign country. I get a free trip, right? So I'm not complaining. It's the privilege of walking the ancient paths of the men and the women in the Bible, and it's an opportunity to pray at holy places, and you know, like the Western Wall and the tomb of our master. So I'm not complaining. It's just, all I'm saying is it's a lot of work. And if I was to take a vacation now, you know, you shouldn't say, didn't he just go on vacation? I'm grateful for the opportunity. Let's put it that way. I'm grateful for the opportunity to make these trips through First Fruits of Zion, not to mention the opportunity to hit those kosher buffets daily. Breakfast and dinner, which allows me the immense privilege of actually assimilating the holiness of the produce of the land of Israel into the tissue of my physical body. And in fact, over 14 days, I was able to assimilate about 10 pounds of that holiness. As it says in Leviticus 3:16, all the fat is the Lord's. And it's mostly olives and kosher meat. But I'm pleased, nevertheless, that we had a very successful trip this year, a wonderful group of people, travelers, pilgrims, fellow Messianic believers, Jews, Gentiles, from all across North America, from Canada, from Trinidad, from South Africa, from Thailand, and even as far as Australia. And among their number, I had the immense privilege of meeting several of your fellow congregants, virtual congregants, who, though they live far away from us and have never visited us in person, they nevertheless follow us remotely through our website, faithfully listening to the sermons and teachings that we post, some even ordering CDs from our Bible studies, some of them attending other Messianic congregations or churches, but for some of them, we are their congregation. Anyway, so on this trip, as you know, God was with us. We were one of the last flights out of New York City, out of JFK, before the hurricane slammed into the city. We were one of the last flights out by a couple hours. And And we were one of the last flights out of Tel Aviv before the rockets started to fall in Tel Aviv. So I thank you for your prayers. Clearly, God's providential hand involved there. So in keeping with our ordinary program, we began our travels in the south, in the Negev, spending two nights in modern Beersheba, where we encountered the Australian Light Horse Brigade, actually, who had come to reenact the Battle of Beersheba, which was the last great cavalry battle, a miracle story in itself, where a gallant group of Australian light brigade soldiers took on the Ottoman Empire in the year 1917, liberated Beersheba from the Turks. I saw the whole thing in an Indiana Jones movie, and they set in motion the events which ultimately returned the Holy Land to Jewish sovereignty. So we had an opportunity to see the Australian flag flying over the ancient archaeological remains of Israelite Beersheba. That was cool. And we actually read about Beersheba in this week's Torah portion, if you're paying attention, in Parshat Toledot. So if you will turn to me, we'll learn a little bit of Bible from Genesis 26. Here in Genesis chapter 26, we read, "Now there was a famine in the land, besides the former famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Gerar, to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And the Lord appeared to him," first time, "and said, 'Do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and to your offspring I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. I will multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven, and I will give to your offspring all these lands. And in your offspring all nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, kept my commandments, kept my statutes, kept my laws.'" So Isaac settled in Gerar. A few things about this passage. First of all, there was a famine in the land. There was a famine in the land in the days of Abraham. You see, Abraham and Isaac were living down there in the Negev, which is on the edge of the wilderness. It's marginal agrable land, sparse rainfall, easily vulnerable to drought and famine. So if there's less than the required rainfall, there will be no agriculture that your Abraham pulls out. He goes down to Egypt, where the Nile is providing plenty of water to wait out the drought. Isaac sees a drought come to the Negev. He's going to do the same thing. He's going to leave. He's going to pull out. But the Lord says to him, "Stay in the land that I will tell you." And he goes to the Philistine king Abimelech of Gerar. Previously in the Torah, Abimelech and Abraham encountered one another when Abimelech of Gerar abducted Abraham's wife inadvertently. He didn't realize it was his wife. He thought it was his sister. And after that episode, they made a treaty, settling a dispute over a well, and they made an oath at the well, and Abraham gave Abimelech seven ewe lambs as a surety. So the name of that place he called Well of the Seven, or Well of the Oath, Beersheba. Beersheba. That was back in the days of Abraham. Now these Philistines are not the same as the Philistines in the days of David and Saul. That's what archaeology tells us. But apparently they're an earlier people group, and the Torah applies the regional name to them. Same situation today, actually. The Palestinians are actually not Philistines, you realize. They are a Semitic people, mostly Arab. Mostly Arab. And a lot of the Palestinians from around Hebron, mostly, in the area of Hebron, I've heard, there's a lot of Jewish Palestinians that don't realize they're Jewish, but, you know, it's sort of that crypto thing, where after the Turks came, they just didn't know why they had always lit candles on Friday nights. It's just what they always did in their family and that sort of thing. But anyway, they're a Semitic people named after the Philistines because they inhabit Palestine, right? So Isaac assumes that he can't live in Gerar, that he can live with in Avimelech's territory because his father, Abraham, made a covenant with Avimelech's father, Avimelech. Avimelech means father of a king. It's like a throne name. It goes down from generation to generation. So Isaac's only concern, he's not worried. He's like, no problem. I'm in with this guy. My dad, his dad, they were like this. No problem. My only concern is that my beautiful wife is gonna get me in trouble. So he comes up with this idea of like, let's just say you're my sister. Same thing his father tried, right? So anyway, you know that episode. Avimelech actually doesn't fall for it this time. He sees out the window, he sees Isaac giving his wife a kiss or something like this, and he says, okay, if that's your sister, that's a sick deal you got going on there. So anyway, it says in verse 12, now Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year a hundredfold, and the Lord blessed him. And the man became rich and continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy. So Isaac's doing very, very well in the land of Gerar. For he had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household, so that the Philistines envied him. They were jealous. Yes, the Philistines were jealous of him. Now the Philistines had stopped and filled with earth all the wells that his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, his father. And Avimelech said to Isaac, go away from us. You are much mightier than we. So Isaac departed from there and encamped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. Valley of Gerar. This is Nahal Gerar. Nahal means river, the river of Gerar. So it's not working out. This whole covenant relationship thing is kind of falling apart here. Isaac's getting chased out of Gerar by the Philistine king. So on that first day of our trip, we were down there. I was telling you, down at Beersheba, right? We're at Beersheba, and you know, we came to Beersheba. I guess Beersheba had been there had been some rockets into Beersheba the day before we arrived, but it was the only noise we heard was those. Was those Yemenite Jews, you know, having a few weddings, you know, they're shooting their firecrackers off and that sort of thing. But so it was quiet, and we were down there in Beersheba, and then that first day, my brother took us someplace he'd never taken a group before. He took us to the Nahal Gerar, which is what we're just reading about here. Isaac in the Valley of Gerar. So he said, let's go see the Nahal Gerar. I'm like, I'm up for this. And he says to the bus driver, he says, you know, I want to go see the Nahal Gerar. And the bus driver said, well, you know, they were shooting out of some rockets yesterday, because this is right down by the, you know, the Nahal Gerar is going to take you right up to the Gaza Strip almost, right? And so he says, they're shooting some rockets. And my brother says, yeah, but I figure they should be going over our head, you know, if we're down by the border. So we go down to the Nahal Gerar there where Isaac, it says, Isaac departed and camped in the valley, the river Gerar. And Steve took us to the Nahal, which is a riverbed. And across the way was Tel Aror, which is the mound of Gerar, the city of Abimelech. You know, it's just a hill now, but where the city once stood. And meanwhile, these modern Philistines are shooting their rockets, right? Not far from us, not that we heard anything or were in any danger at any time. But it's, you know, like I said, it's close to the Gaza Strip. And you probably know that since then, things have escalated and once again are poised on the edge of military action with rockets hitting Tel Aviv and actually even targeting Jerusalem, which is a little unprecedented for these kids. I tend to think of these of the, you know, the Palestinians, the Hamas terrorists that are shooting these rockets as something akin to boys with nothing much to do all day but a stack of bottle rockets in their garage. Anyway, Isaac was pretty put out about being kicked out of Gerar. I mean, after all, remember my father, his father. What's going on here? He had a covenant. He had a treaty with his father, with Abimelech's father. And every time he digs a well, down here in Nahal Gerar, along comes the Philistines, and they claim it. And they say, that's our well. You can't be, that belongs to us.
And so then he moves a little further away, digs another well, and here comes the Philistines. Hey, that's our well. That belongs to us. So he moves a little further away, digs another well. This keeps going on. Finally, he gives up, and he leaves. And he goes back to Beersheba, which I think is significant. We read in verse 23 of this chapter. From there, he went up to Beersheba. Why would he go back to Beersheba? I think he goes back to Beersheba because this is the place where this covenant between his father and Abimelech's father had originally been made. And when you make a covenant, you appoint the deity as a warden of the covenant. So I think he goes back to Beersheba to lodge a complaint and say, hey, what happened to our covenant? This deal that we had. And the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham, your father. Fear not, for I am with you and will bless you and multiply your offspring for my servant Abraham's sake. So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well. And the next morning it says, when Abimelech went to him from Gerar with Ahuzat, his advisor, and Phicol, the commander of his army, Isaac said to them, why have you come seeing that you hate me and have sent me away from you? And they said, we see plainly the Lord has been with you. So we said, let there be a sworn pact between us, between you and us. Let us make a covenant with you that you will do no harm, just as we have not touched you and have done to you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace. Well, that's not exactly true. They've done nothing but good and sent you away in peace. A little exaggeration. This is, you are now blessed of the Lord. They realize you are something. We're missing part. I don't know if you noticed, but we're missing part of the story here. Something happened between our last conversation with Abimelech and the current conversation with Abimelech. What happened? Well, according to the Targum, it had something to do with boils or some sort of itching plague or something like that that came upon the Philistines, some drought, some withering blight that came upon the Philistines when Isaac was kicked out. So, Hashem was watching over the covenant. That's the point. And so he goes to Beersheba. And what do? They make a new covenant at Beersheba. They make a new covenant with each other, and Isaac's servants come and say, hey, we just struck water. And so they name the well Beersheba. Same thing. So there. Now we've done some learning from the Torah portion. And moreover, we once again see how life reflects the Parsha, as the Philistines once again violate their covenant treaties with Israel and are, in fact, shooting bottle rockets at Beersheba. That was actually the first day, actually, you know, just the first two stops on the first day, Beersheba and Nahal Gerar. And every subsequent day, of course, was filled with adventures and remarkable opportunities to place the biblical text right onto the land of Israel with a Bible in one hand. It would be fun to narrate the whole trip, place by place, site by site. That's not possible. Instead, I will share a few highlights with you. While in Jerusalem, we had the opportunity to hear a local Palestinian man address the group. This was a rare opportunity. He is a Christian, a friend of my brother. I'm going to call him David just to protect his identity, which needs to be protected. But as a young man, he was a rock-throwing Palestinian youth, throwing stones at checkpoints, shouting death to America and death to Israel and that sort of thing, and a proud member of the Palestinian Liberation Organization and a supporter of Yasser Arafat. And then someone showed him some kindness. Someone reached out to him and showed him some kindness and invited him to a Christian event, which he came along just to be polite. Someone presented the Messiah to him, and just to be polite, he came along but flatly rejected the whole evangelism thing, had no interest in it, until later that night the Master appeared to him, as he often does in such stories, in these kind of stories. And now David makes his living in the tourist trade, but his real work is missionary work, like Abraham, like we're speaking about, Abraham and Sarah, bringing the gospel to Muslims, changing lives, teaching love in a world of hatred. He works closely with Messianic Jews, actually, in the land of Israel, and other Christian missions, but he's most effective in his own personal outreach. So he's just making friends, and he addressed our group, told us some stories of some prominent Muslims that he's had the privilege of showing some love to, showing some kindness, and bringing them out of Islam and into faith in our righteous Messiah. And he encouraged us to reach out to the Muslim world with love and to show love and present the life-changing gospel of Messiah. He was a wonderful, wonderful, sweet young man. I wish you could meet him. We had small encounters here and there with the Holy One, blessed be he, here and there. Various group members at various places, answers to prayer, a word from Hashem, even a healing. If you travel to Israel seeking God, you generally find him there. It's a local call. So we saw all the regular places, saw Qumran. We actually stood in Cave 11, one of the caves the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in. One of the guys on our group claims to actually have some Dead Sea Scrolls. I think he's not lying. We went to Masada. We went to En Gedi, where we watched the Gedis, the young goats, the ibex playing, and we saw the Nahal David, the waterfall, all that sort of thing. We went to several sites in Jerusalem, including a remarkable new excavation from the Pool of Siloam. I had heard about it. You can actually now climb from the Pool of Siloam up to the City of David on the Herodian Street, all the way underground on this Herodian Street into the sewer system, which the rebels fled after the fall of Jerusalem, even up all the way to the Temple Mount. Unbelievable. Stuff's constantly, constantly being dug up and found. It's always new every time. Steve also brought us to places I'd never been before, like biblical Tamar, a Solomonic city in the south. We visited more churches than we ever have before. Usually we don't go to churches, but this is like the church tour for some reason. So we went to, I love going to these churches. I'm all about that. So we got to see Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. I hadn't been there since I was like a young teenager. But first, my brother brought us to a natural cave outside of Bethlehem in a place called Beit Zoar, where, you know, he said, now here's a first century cave home. You know, it was not like cavemen, but they built over the top of these caves, and then that cave would be your first level. It was really quite nice. It's not like Fred Flintstone. I mean, it's really quite nice. He said, this is where, you know, there's like a manger there, you know, for real. You know, it's like, this is what it would have been like. This is probably what the Church of the Nativity looked like before the Byzantines built a church over the site of the Master's birth. There's fascinating stuff like this. I mean, what can I tell you? Shabbat in Jerusalem. Friday night, we made the obligatory march to the Kotel to participate in the Kabbalat Shabbat prayers. And we enjoyed a Sabbath meal together as a group. And Saturday morning, the group split up. Some walked over to Great Synagogue for services, while others went to Roy Israel, which is the Messianic congregation. A Messianic congregation is Joe Shulam's group, Reb Shulam. And so my son Isaac and I and my brother, we went to Great Synagogue. And we left Great Synagogue, his service was over, click, 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 just done. And my son said, you know, Roy Israel is still going. So we actually got to go to synagogue twice that morning. And most of the group was over there at Roy Israel. And I was really pleased to have the opportunity to go there because they are perhaps the most traditionalist congregation in Israel. I think so. Very much like Beth Emanuel, except that the whole service is in Hebrew. And the whole congregation is squeezed into what appears to be a residential structure. And the congregation keeps a very low profile in Jerusalem out of necessity. It's very nice, very nice. Reb Shulam, unfortunately, was not there. He was traveling, but Chaim ben Chaim of the UMJC offered a Sabbath teaching, a nice teaching about the Messianic principle of loving one's enemies and praying for them. And then David Stern was there. David Stern of the complete Jewish Bible, New Testament. And so David Stern was there, and he gave the gave the group a bracha before we left. He's a very old man now. To me, this congregation, Roi Yisrael, Shepherd of Israel, tucked away there in a quiet Jerusalem neighborhood, to me, is the most important Messianic congregation in the world. Second only to Beth Emanuel, of course. But it is important to me because it's in the land of Israel. It's in the holy city, Jerusalem. And as far as I know, correct me if I'm wrong, it's the only Israeli Messianic Jewish congregation that does teach traditional Torah observance, does do a traditional service, and affirms traditional Judaism as Messianic Judaism. And by the way, we have another connection with them. You may not know this, but when our congregation began 10 years ago, our first Aron Kodesh, the holy ark in which we keep the Torah scroll, was actually a gun case. Yes, it's true. We still have the gun case up in the attic where we keep the golem. But today, thank God, I think we have the most beautiful Aron Kodesh in the whole Messianic movement. Yes, thank God and Paul. But originally we used a gun case. As it says, who despiseth the day of small beginnings, right? So I was pleased to see that Roi Yisrael keeps their Torah scroll in a gun safe with a combination lock on it. It's part of the Sabbath ritual at Roi Yisrael, is turning this combination lock. This is how they protect their Torah scrolls from being stolen by zealous anti-missionaries there in Jerusalem. So it was nice to be there. And some of the young people there were Beth Emanuel virtual listeners, by the way. But as we encountered other Messianic Jews in the land of Israel, the group began to realize the difficult tension that defines Messianic Judaism in Israel. That Messianic Judaism in the land of Israel is, for the most part, not Judaism at all. And most Messianic Jews in the land of Israel are not concerned with keeping the Torah at all, or Sabbath observance, or any aspects of Judaism, because most Israeli Messianic Jews are really just practicing charismatic Christianity or other forms of evangelical Christianity and just happen to be Israelis. They happen to be Israelis, so they call it Messianic Judaism, but it's not. And there are lots of reasons for that. Historical reasons. I could tell you about the history, the origin of the Messianic Jewish movement back in the war for independence, what happened to mark that we're still living with the consequences of things that happened during the war for independence. We're still living with the consequences to this very day. There's historical reasons. There's sociological reasons. There's cultural reasons. We could discuss all of this someday, but for now I'm just telling you this simply so that you can appreciate how unique and how precious it is to find Jewish believers living in the land of Israel who love the Torah and love the Sabbath and are faithful to it. So I took some free time then on Sabbath afternoon to visit some of my favorite places, like Tomb of Mary, Mother of the Master, the Tomb of the Master. Just went, the good news is he's still not there. And my son, Isaac, and I were at the Kotel for Havdalah. That's nice, at the end of the Sabbath. And that was Sabbath in Jerusalem. Over the next few days, we had numerous adventures, exploring Jerusalem, exploring its surrounding environs. We went to the usual places, all the usual places, made our way north to Galilee, made our way to Dan, to Benias, Caesarea Philippi, the Golan Heights, looked across the border into Syria the day before tanks started shooting across the border into Syria. Up in the Galilee last Friday, we had the privilege of seeing the first rains arrive. As you know, Israel has a rainy season, and it has a dry season. The rainy season stretches from about now until around Passover time. The dry season stretches from about Passover to Sukkot. This is the pattern. It's the pattern reflected in our daily prayers. And so we pray for rain for the land of Israel every day, every day. And these prayers have become all the more important in the last decade because Israel has suffered a 7-year drought. That's like biblical proportions there. A 7-year drought, the Sea of Galilee falling to an all-time low. I can't even, I show him my daughter, say, you see those, see that dock, you know, out there, the dock. It doesn't even reach the water anymore, you know, that's how low can you go? 7-year low, this drought, thank God, was broken last year. After we did our first full treatment Hoshana Rabbah service last year, beseeching God for rain, beating the willows on the ground, you remember, and the drought broke, and we had decent rainfall in the land of Israel last year. Now, I can't claim that we're responsible for breaking the drought. Our prayers are just a drop in the bucket of prayers, so to speak. But it's nice to have a share in it when the miracle does come. To have had a share in the petitions when they pay off. Because rain is a big deal in the land of Israel. It's why those who live in Israel have to trust in Hashem. That's what the Torah says. Because this is a land that drinks rain. It drinks water from heaven. And if the rains don't come, if God withholds the rain, as it says in the Shema, He will shut up the heavens and there will be no rain. And the ground will not yield its produce. And you will perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you. Isaiah says in Isaiah 33, says, the land mourns and pines away. Lebanon is shamed and withers. Sharon is like a desert plain. Bashan and Carmel lose their greenery. Amos says, the shepherd's pastures mourn and the summit of Mount Carmel dries up. So the land of Israel waits for rain through the dry season, which is something we can scarcely imagine in Wisconsin. Something's always falling out of the sky here. But try to imagine no rain for 6 months. Everything dry, dusty, dirty, parched, withered. As James, the brother of the master, puts it, he says, the farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it, until it gets the early and late rains. James 5:7. Early rains are the fall rains that break off the summer drought, and the late rains are those that continue towards Passover, the spring rains. Farmer waits for rain. My brother tells a story about a Bedouin. My brother's colleague, James Monson, was out tromping around and down there in the Negev one time, tromping around, and came across an old man sitting on a ridge looking out towards the west, sitting on a ridge, just sitting there. It's old Bedouin man. He asked him, what are you doing? He said, waiting for the rain. This is an amazing thought, you know, waiting for the rain. You remember that story of there had been a 3.5-year drought. Elijah's up on Mount Carmel, defeats the prophets of Baal who are supposed to bring the rain. He's like, who's God? Who's going to bring the rain? And then he looks out, he puts his head between his knees, and he prays, and then he looks out. He's looking out to the Mediterranean Sea, and he sends his servant to look out. The servant comes back, says, do you see anything? He says, I don't see anything. He says, go look again. Goes, looks again, come back. Do you see anything? Doesn't see anything. Sends him out again, and he finally says, I see a cloud, but it's just the size of a man's hand. Way out on the... And so he says to Ahab, hitch up your chariot. It's going to rain. So we were driving up to Galilee when Steve asked our bus driver, my brother asked the bus driver, who is a sweet Christian Arab man from Nazareth, which is how cool is that to be from Nazareth? Anyway, he asked him if he had harvested his olives yet. The guy has some olive trees on his property. And he said, no, we are waiting for the rains. So the olives are ripe. The olives are hanging. They should have been harvested already. They're hanging on the tree, but they need the rain to give them the final weight for the harvest value, so they'll drop from the trees. And since the rains were late and hadn't come yet, the olive harvest, so to speak, was hanging in the balance, withering on the branch. And so we had the privilege of seeing this year's dry season come to an end last Friday. We were at Capernaum, the city of the master, where Simon Peter's house once stood. In fact, that's where we were standing. We were standing outside Simon Peter's house, where the synagogue of the master stood as well, when a storm came barreling in from the west, thunder and lightning, the whole deal, and the clouds broke, and we had to run off the site back to the bus, and we watched as the rain came down. It was torrential. And I couldn't help but think of you, my brothers and sisters, shaking your lulavs and saying Hosanna and beating the floor with your willow branches, because it rained a lot, and it continued on and off all that day and over the Sabbath, on and off. You should have seen the sunset across the Sea of Galilee, where the master walked on the water. See the sunset, an amazing sunset behind storm clouds, with quiet lightning and oranges and reds reflected on the water. And even on our last day, which was last Sunday, we had the awesome privilege then of standing on top of the Carmelite monastery on Mount Carmel, where Elijah defeated the prophets of Baal, and seeing for miles and miles and miles and miles, the whole 2 weeks that we were there, you couldn't hardly see. Visibility was limited. It's the modern world. The sky chokes up with pollution, and there's the heat and the dust and the haze of, you know, all that dust and dirt from 6 months without water, and it obscures the clear view until the rain comes. But when the rains come, it's like it washes the sky clear, and you can suddenly see the vistas of the hills of Transjordan all the way across the Jordan River. Moab, Edom, standing over the land from the top of Mount Carmel. And we could see out to the Mediterranean coast. We could see the waves breaking on the shore far below. And we could see into Transjordan, we could see the Nazareth Ridge, and we could see Mount Tabor, we could see the whole Jezreel Valley spread out below us. And we could see the hill country of Samaria and the sweep of the land beneath bright blue skies, in which mighty mountains of cloud continued to sail from the Mediterranean and to drop their water on the Holy Land of Israel. That's the news from the Holy Land. Someday, I think maybe you will come with, maybe you will make your pilgrimage. I think every Christian should be obligated to visit the land of Israel once in his or her lifetime. It's like a sacred duty, simply on the basis of we should not let Islam one-up us. And so If you have to make the Hajj in Islam, I mean, come on. We can't say no to that. But if not, you will when you arrive on the clouds, those great white clouds that move over the land like mountains. As it says, he is coming with the clouds. And it says, we who are alive and remain will be caught up together with the resurrected in the clouds to meet the master in the air. And the prophet Isaiah foresaw this and said, who are these who fly like clouds and like doves to their lattices? And James, the brother of our master, says, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it, until it gets the early and the late rains. You too, be patient. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near. Shabbat Shalom.
Take on my yoke and learn from me. And find rest for your soul.